I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. If I Had a Hammer was one of the songs that landed the musician and activist Pete Seeger before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s. Our guest Pete Seeger has been writing and popularizing music for more than 60 years. He has always used his voice and his banjo with him today for a purpose. He doesn't sing a song if it doesn't have meaning. His convictions about social justice are deep. His performances have changed lives. And yes, he's got a sense of humor, too. There's little doubt at this point in his life that the FBI has a huge, fat file on him down in Washington. For his liberal politics, he's been the target of mob attacks, too. He has sung anti-American songs in Moscow. He was at one time banned from television. And he's continually inspired other people to action. To stop the Vietnam War, to fight racial inequality, to save the world. Pete Seeger is our guest today. With him in our studio is Jane Sapp, a singer and community activist, co-founder of the Center for Cultural and Community Development in Springfield, Massachusetts. We're talking today about music and social change. Connection listeners, how can music move a mountain or fight for workers' rights or protest a war in the 21st century, in the age of the Internet? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Pete Seeger connection. Welcome, Jane Sapp, too.
That's right.
Ever and always, Pete Seeger, you're a man with a message. First of all, thank you for joining us. But tell us about the message.
First of all, I'm just as stupid as any other man at various times. Ask my family. My wife and my three children and our three children and our five grandchildren are quick to tell me off.
Talk back to Pete Seeger, my God.
And I give up regularly about 9 o'clock at night. Every day I say the hell with it. Go to sleep. And I would like to correct one thing you said. I didn't sing an anti-American song in Moscow. I sang a rather sad lament for a soldier killed in Vietnam. And the words I got from a letter in a local newspaper. A woman wrote, I live in a small town on the banks of the Hudson River. And she said, I think you should know what my late husband wrote me a month ago. He said, we've no friends here. I sleep with a pistol under my head. It's my own troops I have to watch out for. And last week, his casket came home. Well, I put it into rhyme. He said, we've no friends here, no, hardly a one. We've got a few generals who just want our guns. But it'll take more than that if we're ever to win. Why, we'll have to flatten the country. It's my own troops I have to watch out for, he said. I sleep with a pistol right under my head. He wrote this last month. Last week he was dead, and Simon came home in a casket. It's part of a longer song. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud that Bernice Regan of Sweet Honey in the Rock sang it on a recording last year. She's got a voice. Wow. Doesn't she have a great voice?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Jane, I think people listening to this program would be interested in your ideas for how children could spend their summers learning the arts.
Well, I'm interested in thinking about culture camps for young people. That might be a way to give a lot of our kids a chance, one, to meet each other, especially if you made these camps, multicultural camps. It would also be a way for kids to spend some time feeling the power of their own possibilities, finding their voice in singing, finding their talent in not only creating music, making instruments, making quilts, writing poetry together, singing, dancing together, doing theater, drama together. I think that the idea of culture camps with young people, because I heard Chris say, well, what do we do in the 21st century when you think about internet and all these other kinds of things? It seems to me that one of the most important things that we can do in the 21st century is to begin to reconnect with each other, to actually feel the power of being in the presence and feeling the strength and humanity of another human being.
That's what we try to do in this program every day. It's all about a connection at a lot of levels that we don't entirely understand. I'd love to know, Jane, what you're doing in Springfield, and then how, you know, Pete Seeger's consciousness, Pete Seeger's history, Pete Seeger's example in the 20th century kind of has to be translated in a new technology, new media, new millennium.
I met Pete Seeger in 1978. We talked about that a little last night, the concert that we did together. And when I met Pete in 78, I was at a transition in my own life, and that is from a solo, well, actually doing a lot of group work, working with choruses, to suddenly finding myself as a solo performer, something that I had not done before. And I remember being backstage. Pete and I, starting in 1978, did a lot of concerts together. And I don't know, Pete, if you remember this, but this was at a concert in Chicago
Right.
when we sang at that church. And I asked you backstage, I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm so scared to go out there and sing by myself. I said, I'm so used to working with choirs and with choruses. I come out of the South, the Baptist church tradition and whatever. And you said, well, Jane, just go out there and make that audience your choir. And it just changed everything for me from that point on. But it was more than just saying, Pete, make the audience your choir, but you were really saying to me, go out there and try to make a community. That was what I heard you say. Make a community, make a singing community. And so, Chris, the question that you ask about what is the work that I do in Springfield and how does it follow up on sort of my connection with Pete and my understanding of his work is how do you create community? How do you take voices singing together and make a community out of that? And not even just having people sing together as a community, but what are the lessons that we learn from making a community? And I was just saying to Pete, we were having a discussion before this program began, that when you start talking about choruses, that there's a way to talk about leadership. There's a way to talk about how people cross lines. For example, I have a chorus in Springfield that crosses all kinds of lines, cultural lines. We have people who sit in that chorus who are Jewish, who are Baptists, who are come from sort of the poorer end of Springfield to those who come from the wealthier end. And yet they are sitting there singing together, not only discovering voices together, but also discovering lives together and possibilities.
Amen. Amen.
Together.
I sing in a Black Baptist chorus myself, rehearsed last night. It's an important thing. We also discover, kind of to our surprise, on this program, we make a community every day. But let's ask Pete Seeger to instruct us, take us how to make it a community, make it our choir, Pete Seeger. What's that process, especially in this age of not analog folk
audiences in a small place together every night, but more and more on through the miracle of radio and the internet in a kind of mysterious, huge audience that we don't see.
I think one looks for elements in any culture which are the positive ones and how to bring them out. Consider that once upon a time, our ancestors, I'm talking about tens of thousands of years ago, all lived in little villages, and they all knew just one religion, whatever their words they used. They knew one kind of music. All the men knew the same hunting songs. All the women knew the same lullabies. And then technology comes along, and cities grow, and different kinds of people find themselves living near each other, suspiciously, but having to somehow survive together. And now in the United States, it's extraordinary. Most big cities in the United States are full of people who speak different languages and have different names for God and different words for their philosophy, whatever it is. And yet, we're going to survive as a human race or we're not. Technology has also made it possible for us to wipe each other off the face of the earth. I'm not just talking about nuclear bombs. I'm talking about all the genetic information we have now. And it's only a matter of time before any insane person could get the information probably off the internet.
Imagine Jane Sapp, though, gave you the advice you gave her. Go out there and make it your chorus. Use your banjo, if you like. Preach to the audience today. Get them singing with you.
I start with usually something pretty simple. With kids, it might be, hey, hey, skip to my loo.
I'm ready.
With older kids, matter of fact, last night, I did a little rap song. I learned this from Josh White, Jr. Josh, his father, was a great blues singer I knew back 50 years ago. And Josh White, Jr., read a book written by a former English professor up here in New England, a man named Richard Lederer, and he wrote a book called Crazy English.
We know Richard Lederer. Oh, do we know Richard Lederer?
Well, Josh simply lifted out of the first chapter of his book a whole bunch of little things, and I added a little refrain for the audience to join in. English is the most widely used language in the history of the planet. One out of every seven human beings can speak or read it. It has the largest vocabulary, perhaps 2 million words. But English is crazy. Help me out next time. Just a few examples. There's no egg in eggplant. No pine or apple in pineapple. A writer writes, but fingers don't fing. Grocers don't gross. Quicksand works slowly. Boxing rings are square. English is crazy. So on. It goes on like that for several
Keep
minutes.
Keep doing it, man. We'll have everybody singing sooner or later.
Well, you start with something simple like that, and then later on, people realize they can sing in harmony, and they can do what they call in churches is call and response.
Amen.
Bach called it antiphony. I usually write it as A-U-N-T, capital T-I-F-F-A-N-Y. But antiphony is a wonderful thing, and the more of it, I just think it's great. Maybe Jane, I've often thought, I wish somebody would print some of the famous old African-American songs, which most people have just learned as one melody, but instead print them as at least two or more things going on. Mm-hmm. Like gonna lay down my sword and shield way down.
Yeah.
And the basses have a low note, mm-hmm. and then the high voices answer back.
Yeah.
Or Saints Go Marching In. When I learned this from Lee Hayes, he says, Pete, that song couldn't be sung by one person. Oh, when the saints, oh, when the saints go marching in. When when the saints go marching in. Lee was a good bass singer. Lee, incidentally, was the man who wrote the words of the Hammer song. He doesn't get enough credit. He also wrote the words of Kisses Sweeter Than Wine.
Mm.
He was very good at putting words together. And I'm only sorry he died about 15, 20 years ago.
We're tickled that you're with us on The Connection, Pete Seeger. I've had a lot of calls this morning. Just folks heard the promo said you're the luckiest man in America. To be sitting talking to Pete Seeger, Connection listeners, you can all do it at 1-800-423-8255. The Pete Seeger Connection with Jane Sapp from Springfield, Massachusetts, with him in the studio this hour. 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Mark.
How is everybody?
I'll
tip
top.
To the point, you know, with music, it's often been a item that many governments have pretty much tried to cover up or try to hold back. Good example, in Britain, the bagpipe is still banned in British Parliament. but there, with music, there's been a lot of protest songs that have gone through the years. One that comes to mind is when the band played Waltzing Matilda, and that was a World War I protest song about the Australians' participation in that war. But then you look into on the American shores, you have Yankee Doodle, which was a protest song of British government, but also it was originally a song written by Britons or Tories to make fun of the colonials. So it's nice that you could take a song and twist it two different ways. You could take the same music and add different lyrics to it. You know.
You're absolutely right. Things turn upside down all over the place. It can happen for good or bad.
The world turned upside down.
Yeah.
But that's all I had to say.
Mark, thank you for saying it.
No problem.
Pete Seeger.
Jane, I would like to hear you tell more about your plans for getting young people involved in music, because I saw you in the Springfield School with small children and medium-sized children and older children, and you had them all singing with a kind of a sing-out feeling. They weren't just holding back. They were just, the way kids do, full of enthusiasm.
Is there a trick to it, Jane?
Well, I don't think there's a... I'm not sure I think that there's a trick to it, but I do think that... we have to really understand that the schools are not engaging our kids, and that we need to find ways to get our children involved in thinking about themselves, thinking about the possibilities of their own lives. We need to get young people thinking that it's possible for them to do things. I think that the schools are destroying the spirits of our kids. And that music is one way to re-engage kids. And quite frankly, I do think that the schools are destroying the spirits of young African-American kids and Latino kids in the schools, and that music is a way to address that. And so, Pete, when you talk about the spirit that you see from the kids, that's what's happening. We tend to think of music as just, and I think, Chris, you may have kind of alluded to this when you said, you know, yes, we have that amen Baptist feeling, and it's a great feeling, but that it is much more than that. That music is a way of giving voice to people's spirit, to people's lives. It is a way to give voice to what people are thinking. I think, you know, that for young people in our schools, when, as my son says, that most teachers in the schools now are like workers at McDonald's. If it does not look like it's in that square box and the little letters that they see and the pictures that they see, they can't think beyond that. Music gives our kids a way to get outside of that box, not to feel that they are trapped in the box that most teachers think in. So it gives them a way to voice their intelligence, It gives them a way to voice their dreams, to voice their hope, to voice their anger, to voice their vision. And so when you bring music into the schools, especially, I think, Pete, the kids that you heard last night and the kids that you've heard in Springfield, other kids I've worked with around the country, you are doing much more than just saying, we're going to have a happy time singing some songs. But you are giving these kids a space to give voice to who they are and everything it is that they're feeling about what has been denied of them in the schools and in the communities, not necessarily in the communities in which they live, but certainly what has been denied of them by this society.
Oh, you should have heard them last night. I'm glad to be me.
That's right.
Did you write that song?
No, that actually comes from Rose Sanders in Selma, Alabama. Again, Hank Sanders that you met.
Yeah.
I don't want to be you. I just want to be me. Yeah.
I was going to ask, what other kinds of songs do you begin that process with?
I get the kids to write their own songs.
Really?
Yeah. I ask young people what it is that you think and feel about the world, and if you had your opportunity to say to people, this is who I am, this is what I think, this is what I know, this is what I feel. Hear my voice, hear my thoughts, hear my intelligence, hear my knowledge, hear my experiences. So we have songs where kids talk about their vision of the world. If I had the world in my hands, everything would change. If I had the world in my hands, there would be no more violence. There would be no more misery. There would be no more suffering if I had the world in my hands.
Jane Sapp is hatching all manner of little Pete Seegers, who's our guest in the studio today. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. 1-800-423-TALK. Pepper is on the line.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks very much for taking my call. Hello, Pete. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Pepper.
Hi.
Jane, I'm very glad to hear your voice.
Hi, Pepper.
It's been a long time.
Yes.
I just wanted to say very quickly that if it were not for Pete's music, many of us baby boomers would still be sitting in our living rooms, probably doing nothing. Likewise for your music, Jane. The energy has kept my social, spiritual, emotional, and political elements of life afloat. Especially now, the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium. And there truly is a choice. It doesn't have to be just this is the way someone says it. We can make the choice. And I need to plug Pete's Circle of Song and Jane's Children of Selma. So thank you both very much, and I hope the party goes well tonight.
Pepper, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
1-800-423-8255. Roland is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Roland.
Hi. I just wanted to give a little plug to Camp Killooleet, which is where I was first introduced to Pete Seeger's music and then Pete Seeger in person. It was just an amazing camp run by John and Ellie Seeger, and it really changed my life. I was a very shy 10-year-old boy. I had no friends. I was really very lonely. And that was the first time in my life that music was valued and that people were open, and it was really inspiring to me. And I've gone on to, make music my life, and I really want to just say that Camp Killooleet really changed my life.
Roland, thank you.
I got a large family, and my older brother and his wife of many years run a nice, wonderful little camp up in Vermont. Now my niece is running it. She lives in Somerville here.
Yeah.
Kate Seeger. Maybe some have heard her. You've heard her singing with two other women who are short. They call themselves the Short Sisters. They sang a song which I can't do justice to, although I put the song together years ago. May, the flowers bloom, a June wedding, an empty room. July was very warm, oh, lie low, lie low, lie low. August, we beat the heat, fled the suburbs for the beach. September, back to school, low. Lie, low, lie, low, lie, low. October, red and gold. November, turning cold. December, round the tree, oh. Lie, low, lie, low, lie, low. January brought the snow. February, skiing, all did go. March, how did the wind blow? Lie low, lie low.
Pete Seeger is our guest.
You didn't get the verse, which is important.
We've got to take a short break. We'll be back.
I'm going to sing that
Pete
last
Seeger
verse even after the break.
And Jane said, do it.
El arroyo de la sierra me complace más que el mar. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. One more time. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera, Guantanamera.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Pete Seeger Connection.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Pete Seeger, that song must sound familiar by now.
Where have all the young girls gone? Long time.
Song didn't go anywhere until somebody else recorded it. Joe Hickerson, who later on became in charge of the archives of folk song at the Library of Congress, had a job at summer camp, and they were kidding around. Where have all the counselors gone? Broken curfew, everyone. But by the end of the summer, they agreed that they should extend two extra verses, where have the soldiers gone and where have the graveyards gone? Mm. And Peter, Paul, and Mary heard some kids in Greenwich Village singing it. They were back from camp. And they started singing it. They thought it was an old folk song. And the Kingston Trio picked it up from them. My manager says, Pete, did you ever write a song called Where Have All the Flowers Gone? I said, yeah, about 3 years ago. He said, did you ever copyright it? And I said, no, I guess it didn't. He said, well, you ought to. The Kingston Trio just recorded it. Well, I knew Dave Gard well. He'd gotten started buying a copy of my mimeographed book, How to Play the Five-String Banjo. And he said, oh, Pete, we didn't know it was your song. We'll take our name off it. He was very nice because technically I had, as they say in the trade, abandoned copyright. However, they took their name off it, put my name on it, and now it pays my taxes. Somebody plays it on a radio station in Tokyo, and I get another penny.
That's a lot of pennies over the years.
Actually, the best the person who really spread it was Marlene Dietrich, who had a wonderful German translation made. It sings better than the English. Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Mädchen, flüchten sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen? And she took it. She had a one-woman show, took it all around the world. Mm. And The man who did the translation just died last January, Max Cullett.
Was it your melody?
It's actually swiped from an Irish melody. A friend of mine pointed this out.
Stealing from the Irish again. There they go.
That's right. Yeah, remember, there was an Adirondack lumberjack song, an Irish-American song. Johnson says he'll load more hay, says he'll load 10 times a day. But the original idea for the song was from a Russian song, Koloda Duda, and the three verses I read in a famous Soviet novel, and Quiet Flows the Don, describing the Cossack soldiers galloping off to join the Tsar's army 100 years ago, singing, where are the flowers? The girls have plucked them. Where are the girls? They're all married. Where are the men? They're all in the army. And I stuck the three lines on it in my pocket, saying, someday I should look up that song. I never got around to it, never got time, but I was sitting in an airplane on my way to sing at Oberlin, and all of a sudden another line, I thought, long time passing. That would sing well. And I put them together, and all of a sudden I had a new song. Mm. Right now I'm trying to find the address of Folklore Archives in Moscow, because I got a campaign on, I'm trying to start, whereby songs that have something of the public domain in them, some money from the royalty should go to where that song came from. Mm. In this case, Russia. Right now I'm also trying to find an address in South Africa. I can send money for the song Abiyoyo. It's a South African lullaby. And I've had money came in royalties for a song. So it's a storybook, Abiyoyo. Money, money, money. It seems to control the world, and if we don't watch out, it will end the world. On the other hand, Jane can tell you all the things she has found being done not for money. All around, Rose Sanders down there in Selma, Alabama, writing beautiful songs without a thought of making any money out of it. Mm-hmm. And what songs. You should have been there last night at MIT. She had two of her choruses, mainly the adult chorus was mainly, but not all, white, and the children's chorus was mainly African-American, but not all. And then they were singing together. Wow.
And what were they singing, Jane?
Oh, they were singing songs of hope, of justice, freedom.
And getting the whole audience singing along with them.
Gospel songs. Some of Pete Seeger's songs.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Pete Seeger connection with Jane Sapp, too. 1-800-423-TALK. Judy is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Judy.
I met Pete, many years ago in 1953 in Poughkeepsie, New York, at the little Quaker school, Oakwood. And at that time, it was quite a matter to stick your neck out, if you will, during those hearings. I would like to think, I was very young at the time, that the school paid you for your wonderful appearances that charmed us. And very shortly thereafter, between you and the farm and wilderness camps, I did become a convinced friend, a Quaker. And since that time, in a life largely involved in politics, your music, of which I have your three original records, and those experiences made it much easier for me, I felt, to stick my neck out on the behalf of either unpopular people or causes in the view of the broader public. And you just had a major effect, not only on me, but on many of my friends, I'm quite sure.
I think one reason you could do this is a lot of times a song is not quite as, doesn't try to be quite as explicit as just plain talking. Mm. And that's, it's a little ambiguous the way life is. It has different meanings. I think of a good song as a basketball backboard, and it bounces back different meanings as you bounce the experiences of your life against it.
That's a wonderful analogy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you had a major effect, and I thank you for it.
Judy, thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Pete Seeger connection. Av is on the line.
Yes, hi. Good morning, everybody.
Welcome, Av.
Thanks a lot. I'm a huge, huge, huge Pete Seeger fan. Been ever since I was about 4, I think, as long as I can remember. Pete, I'm wondering if you remember a guy named John Cronin.
Sure do.
Of the River Keepers.
Know him well.
That's my uncle.
No fooling.
No fooling. And I'm kind of interested in what you think about the younger generation of artists and singers, because with the exception of, like, Bruce Springsteen or U2, I just don't find that they're willing to take on the big political issues that you did when you were a real young man, and what you think that says about, you know, young people's involvement in some of these issues. Because if the artists aren't doing it, who's going to inspire them to do it?
First of all, I urge you not be misled by what you hear on the air or see on the air, see on the little screen. There's thousands, for all I know, tens of thousands of people using arts to help pull people together and to express things which the newspapers aren't telling them, or for that matter, the radio or TV doesn't usually tell them. And you only hear the names of a few commercial people that the powers that be want to promote, because they can make some money out of them. And those poor people allow themselves to be promoted and don't realize they're going to be thrown aside a year or two later for somebody else to get promoted. The commercial scene is really pretty foolish. It can, of course, you can temporarily really reach a whole lot of people. The Weavers, it happened to us in the year 1950.
Was it Good Night, Irene?
Well, we never expected to be well known. We were on the point of literally splitting up because Ronnie wanted to raise a family and Fred wanted to go back to college and get a master's degree. Lee wanted to write short stories for a living. He was a very good writer. But I wanted to sing with a group, and I knew there were some songs I could not sing by myself. Saints Go Marching In was one of them, and Weema Ware was another. Hmm. And I said, as a last resort, let's take a job. We got a job in a tiny Greenwich Village nightclub, and sometimes there were so few people to listen to us, we quit singing at the mic and sat down at the table with the four people in the nightclub. There were only four people there. But the manager had faith in us. On weekends, he got a few more, and next month, a few more. We stayed there for 6 months. After the end of the fourth month, we're getting huge crowds, and one of the people was a very well-known band leader, Gordon Jenkins. Hmm. And he enthusiastically said, "Will you come up to Decca? I want to get you to record for Decca." I thought he was joking. But sure enough, he did, and our record, Goodnight Irene, was the big hit of the summer of 1950. You couldn't escape that song. I remember hearing it on a jukebox in a diner, and somebody said, "Turn that thing off. I've heard it 50 times today." But it stayed up number one June, July, August. It stayed up there all summer. And the blacklisters probably said, "How did we let these commie so-and-sos slip through our fingers?" And they started chopping us down. Pretty soon, we couldn't get a job on TV. Pretty soon, the big nightclubs wouldn't hire us. We were down to singing in Daffy's Bar and Grill on the outside of Cleveland. And so in 52, we took a sabbatical. And as Lee said, it turned into a Mundical and a Tuesical. But a friend of ours, Harold Leventhal, he's my age, mm-hmm. and he had once been a song plugger for Irving Berlin back in the 30s as a young man. And he said, "Would you be willing to have a reunion concert?" We said, "Sure, if you can find a hall that will be willing to rent to us." Town Hall was scared, said, "No, we can't rent to you." However, Carnegie Hall said, "If you have the money, we'll rent to you." My gosh, it was packed. And all of a sudden, the Weavers were in business again. But by this time, I was singing by myself, and my own family was growing up. You can't be a member of a quartet and have a family, really. It's hard.
Could I ask you just to tell the story about the stone you've been carrying around for 30 years, waiting to throw it?
Well, there was a movie made about that, actually, A Song and a Stone. Not a very good movie. But in April 1938, I get a phone call from a poet, John Beecher by name. He was a distant descendant of Harriet Beecher Stowe or Henry Ward, one of those Beechers. And he said, Pete, I'm down here at Duke University reading poems to thousands of students. I said, well, what do you want me for? He says, they're sitting down in the courtyard and they're refusing to go to classes. I said, why? He says, well, after Dr. King got assassinated, a committee of students went to the president's house and said, we think you should resign from your white-only country club. We think you should give more scholarships to black people. We think you should give more, be willing to bargain in good faith with the maintenance employees, most of them African-American. Well, the president said, thank you for your advice, but I'm running this university. Good night. In the morning, he got up and found they were still in his living room. They'd used his john. They were using his kitchen. And they said, we don't think that's a good enough answer. We're staying here till we get a better one. But he walked out the door and ate breakfast somewhere else. Came back that evening. They were still in his living room. And this went on for 5 days. He went to live in the infirmary. And they decided to move their protest out of his house to the courtyard of this huge, very conservative university. I mean, this is where the executives of the big Southern corporations send their children to Duke. And the demonstrators grew from a few hundred to a few thousand. There they were sitting down, and I, at John Beecher's, after John Beecher's call, I hopped in a plane and flew down and said, how is it I haven't heard about this? This is astonishing. You middle-class white kids going out on a limb, you're going to lose your scholarships. You're certainly going to be set back in school, sitting here and not going to classes. And they said, well, the New York Times did give us a couple inches on the back page. We called up NBC, we called up CBS. They said they couldn't spare the cameraman. But then they said, let us know if there's any violence. We'll send somebody down. That's how our country is misruled, by misinformation. Year after year, decade after decade, the American people know what the media wants them to know. And if they start learning things too much, they learn how to twist it. So the kids of the 60s were just interested in drugs. The people in Seattle were just interested in throwing stones through windows. Ha! Well, I picked up a stone. I said, I've never thrown a stone at a person. I've had them thrown at me. It's no fun. But if I'm ever at a place where they say they're not going to cover a good story because it's not important, a window may get broken. There are thousands of good stories going on in this country every day of the year. Do we read of them in the papers? Do we hear of them on the air? Jane Sapp is doing one of the most extraordinary things in Springfield. I tell people, when people ask, how are you, Pete? I say, I'm senile, but still here. I'm losing my memory. I couldn't remember the name of Springfield for 5 seconds. She and her husband and their kids, she's got a wonderful family, live in Springfield, have for 15 years now? 10?
10.
10 years. And she has gone to the schools in Springfield, said, I want to help. Get the kids singing. I don't know how much you get paid for that.
Millions and millions and millions.
She just held up her hand. She gets paid zero for leading these choruses in the Springfield school.
It's important work, and it's important encouragement, too, from Pete Seeger. Jane Sapp, keep doing it. You're listening to The Connection. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Laura is on the line.
Hi, yes, I'm the director of the Girl Scouts in the Greater Boston area, and I wanted to tell you that you're on target. The commercial music today often divides children against each other, but 40 million women can go and sing together in Girl Scouting on a constant basis using the old favorites, and I think Pete Seeger has done a lot to keep that alive.
Laura, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Pete Seeger connection. John is on the line.
Good morning.
Hello, John.
How are you?
Good. Welcome.
Could Pete say a few words about the Almanac Singers and Woody Guthrie from the early 40s?
Well, Woody Guthrie hitchhiked to New York in February of 1940, and when he went into a diner to warm himself up and have a cup of coffee, he'd hear Kate Smith singing God Bless America. And he started writing out verses that occurred to him. All the verses were kind of from the viewpoint of somebody who was on a highway, on a road. And then the last line of his verse, he said, God Bless America for me, because he was hearing that song. I never heard him sing it till 1949, when he recorded it for a tiny little company called Folkways. Big sale for them was 1,000 records. And by this time, he changed the last line to, This Land Was Made for You and Me. And now everybody knows his song. It got into the schools and school songbooks. Well, Woody and I met, were working with Alan Lomax, the folklorist, and he had a big pile of recordings, old country, the Hillbilly Catalog was what they called Nashville music in those days. And black music was what they called the Race Catalog, whether it was gospel songs or blues. And Alan had made a big collection of these songs, and he also had some union song sheets, and he says to Woody and me, maybe you can work all this into a book. And Woody and I sat down. In 6 weeks, we had a book called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People. And then Woody taught me how to ride freight trains, and I went off just learning about America for the summer of 1940. In the fall, I've come back to New York, and I hear there's a man named Lee Hayes wants to put out a book of union songs and hard-hitting songs of a sort, whatever he was going to call it. And I figured, we better get together. I knock on his door, find he's the son of an Arkansas preacher, and we immediately found ourselves singing together. And Lee was a good song leader. He taught me a great deal about lining out the hymn. And his roommate, Millard Lampel, good writer, he got later on got an Oscar for some of his movie scripts. Anyway, the three of us call ourselves the Almanac Singers, and I wrote letters to Woody. He was out and making up songs about the Grand Coulee Dam at this time. He said, you ought to come back and join us. We're singing for unions. We're in Madison Square Garden singing songs for the transport workers. We had a song about the train that never returned. Well, Woody walked into our door June 23rd or 24th, 1941. I remember a wry grin on his face. I never think about Woody without a grin curling the edges of his lips. He says, well, I guess we won't sing any more peace songs, will we? I said, you mean we have to support Churchill? Yep, Churchill says, all aid to the gallant Soviet allies. I says, is this the same man who said, strangle the Bolshevik infant in its cradle? He says, yep, Churchill's flipped-flopped, we got to. And Woody was right. So we'd stopped singing peace songs, but we went west singing union songs all the way across the country, and that was the Almanacs.
Pete Seeger, it's a huge pleasure for me and for all our listeners to have you on The Connection. Jane Sapp, who's founded the Center for Cultural and Community Development in Springfield, Massachusetts, and is working, a fellow at MIT this spring, too?
With the Center for Reflective Community Practice, and I think it's really important to say that it's because of that center that we have Pete Seeger here.
Yeah, thank you for making it happen, and let's do it again. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
When we learn that the union makes us strong, solidarity forever, solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to the news, all about international adoption from a man who knows, because he and his